Okay, so today we're really going to start looking at GPU architecture. You know, last Wednesday, Varun showed us what a CPU looked like. He definitely convinced me that CPUs do quite a bit to make a single instruction stream or a few instruction streams run really efficiently. And now I'm going to talk about running hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of instruction streams on the GPU. And then we'll stop about 10 o'clock because I want to go over using Git to do the homework assignments. Because this is something totally new. I don't know if any class has tried to use Git or source control in general for all the homework assignments. So I want to try to ease the learning curve for you guys. But before we talk about the GPU architecture, I just want to show a little bit of motivation for why to design the GPU the way it is when you look at the kind of workloads that it needs to handle. So what I want to show you here is, you see this globe application. This is something like what you'll code in one of your assignments, this 3D globe here. And you'll notice on one side it's lit by the sun. And on the other side it shows a night lights texture. It's kind of dark up there. And then where it's lit by the sun, you see a specular highlight there where it's really bright, right where my mouse is, in the water. But as you come over the land, you don't see the specular. So you have a specular right there, but not so on the land. And then we also see clouds. And then on the flip side, the clouds kind of cover the night lights. And then you also see this atmosphere. You see where it kind of turns orange as day meets night. And then we also see bumps here. We call this bump mapping, where the mountains are. You see the extra exaggeration. And then the clouds also have shadows. Or these are pretty cheesy shadows I added, but they're shadows. So you're going to build later in the semester, we're going to write code that does something very similar to this for one of the assignments. But I want to look at the workload here, right? So when you're looking at an individual pixel, we have to determine, is it in day or is it in night? Is it water? Is it not water? Is it a cloud? Is it not a cloud? Is it in the shadow? Not in the shadow? Right, so there's some memory access here because we have textures for the day and the night side, which are 2D images. But there's also quite a bit of math going on. You know, are we in shadow? We're going to trace a ray and see if we go through that shadow map. Or just what side of the globe are we on? That's really a dot product, to look at the sign of the dot product to where the light source is. The most important thing here, though, is that any pixel can be shaded in parallel with any other pixel. So if I'm going to color, say, a pixel over here, I can do that at the same exact time that I'm coloring a pixel over here. Right? These are completely independent. In fact, we say they're embarrassingly parallel, right? So you might have a 2-megapixel image, right? That's a very common size to have. And all of those fragments can be processed in parallel, at least in this very simple case. We will look at cases where there is an order, but in a lot of cases, you're going to have millions of fragments that can all be shaded at the same time. So that's a very data parallel thing, too, that we're going to talk about. This is just one example of parallelism in graphics, looking at each individual pixel. There's also vertices. This is modeled with a triangle mesh, and each individual vertex can be transformed in parallel. And then the triangles, they can all be processed in parallel. There's just parallelism all throughout the graphics pipeline. So when we look to build hardware to accelerate graphics, we're really looking to exploit the parallelism that's in it. And this is a really fun assignment that you guys will do after spring break that I think you'll really like. So is that clear to everyone when I said that there's a lot of parallelism here? And it's very simple parallelism. It's not like you're on the CPU and you're locking left and right, transferring data. I mean, really, all these things are processed independently when they're doing that shading computation to pick a color for an individual pixel. Okay, great. So with that said, I'm going to jump into a slide deck here from Kayvon. Have you guys heard of not invented here syndrome? Have you guys ever heard of that in software? There's this idea called not invented here syndrome where, like, as software developers, we always want to redo everything. You know, I'm not going to reuse that code. I don't like that. That code is old. It's not good. I'm going to write my own code. Or I'm not going to go buy a third-party library. I'm going to write my own library. And some people have, you know, just a big case of not invented here syndrome. I am somewhat guilty of that, certainly with slides. And in fact, this will be the only time that you're going to see me use someone else's slides straight up. I think it's really hard to teach off of someone else's slides. But Kayvon's slides here, he's been presenting this at SIGGRAPH for several years, and this is like the best GPU architecture introduction that I've ever seen. So I think that reason his slides here are really great. And now he's an assistant professor at CMU, where he teaches similar courses, actually, to this course. So let's get started. We're really going to look at three big ideas for what makes a GPU run so fast. And we're going to take a brief look at these modern architectures, which is the GTX 480 from NVIDIA, and then the Radeon 5870. The interesting thing here is the Radeon 5870, their newer GPU that's coming out after that, is actually starting to look a lot more like NVIDIA's GPU. And we'll briefly touch the NVIDIA named the architectures today, but later in the semester, Varun is going to do a whole lecture on kind of modern, very modern architectures for the GPUs. And we'll look briefly at the memory hierarchy, and we'll see that there's always memory bandwidth is a huge deal in GPUs. Getting memory to individual processors is a big deal, and getting memory from your CPU to the GPU is also a big deal. And when we look at the major ideas behind building these processors, there's really three things that we want to look at, which is how are these GPUs designed. And then when we're writing code, because ultimately I care about you guys understanding the architecture, but I really care about you guys writing code that runs on the GPU. And to do so, you really need to understand the architecture. Like, you can write pretty good CPU code and really not have a clue what the CPU is doing underneath it. But today, at least, when you're writing the GPU code, you really have to understand GPU architecture. Now, 5 years from now, that might not be true or might not be as true, but today we really need to understand the GPU architecture in order to optimize our code. And then really, the final point here, we look at workloads. What workloads will run efficiently on the GPU and what will run efficiently on the CPU? Loosely speaking, on the GPU, we need something that is massively parallel, embarrassingly parallel, where lots of the same computations can happen at the same time. And we also like things that have a lot of compute relative to memory access. So you might just read two. So if you just read two values and add them, that's probably not a very good use of the GPU. But if you read two values and do a lot of number crunching on them, like we do in shading with graphics, where you're doing square roots, you're doing trigonometric functions, dot products, all that kind of stuff, then you're really getting into really utilizing the compute power for the GPU. Okay. Oh man. Last year, when I gave this talk, I realized that the text was hard to read, and I never went and changed it. But the first big idea here for the GPU is that it's a heterogeneous multiprocessor, right? And here is an example core, which I'm going to skip for the moment because we're going to build this up in future slides. But here's an example of code that is running, shading each individual pixel, like I showed you in the globe example. And this is a very simple diffuse shader, which what it does is it, in this line here, and this is actually written, by the way, in HLSL, which is Direct3D's shading language, high-level shading language. When we're doing graphics in this class, we're going to be doing GLSL, which is the OpenGL shading language. I would say I don't know HLSL, but the languages are so similar that, like, you know, you might not even know which one you're looking at because they're very similar. And there's also quite a bit of converters where people convert from GLSL to HLSL and vice versa. But this code here would execute for each pixel. And what it does is it reads a value from a texture or a 2D image. So just like, you know, I said we have a 2D image for the day texture in that globe example. And then this dot product here is simply doing what we call diffuse lighting, which those of you that have the 416, 560 background know exactly what it is. And that's just determining the intensity, the brightness of that color based on where the sun is or where the light source is and the normal, the orientation for that fragment. And then we just multiply the intensity from the light by the texture sample, and we output the pixel. And we do this for every pixel on the screen. Right. A really important point here is that there's no explicit parallelism. When a programmer writes this shader, you just say, here, when every fragment goes or every pixel is shaded, execute this code. And that's it. You don't have to launch multiple threads. You're not doing anything. The one reason that GPUs and OpenGL and Direct3D are so successful as a parallel programming model is because the parallelism is completely implicit. So it makes it really easy to program from a parallel programming perspective. And also, you see, I'm already bad with my terminology. I'm going back between pixel and fragment. I'm using those two words. Do you guys know the difference between a pixel and a fragment? Yep, go ahead. The section is an actual. Not in the context that I'm looking for, but I could see someone using the term fragment very loosely in that. Any other ideas? So a pixel is, as you said, it's part of the actual screen. It's one individual picture element on the screen that has a color. And a fragment is potentially a pixel, but if it's on the back part of a model relative to the viewer, it might not actually become a pixel. So not all fragments become pixels, right? Like if we were drawing this scene, say from your perspective, the blackboard behind the projector screen, that's a fragment, but it's going to wind up losing the depth test, and the pixel on the screen is actually going to be, or the fragment on the screen will actually become a pixel. And we'll talk quite a bit actually about optimizing to minimize the amount of fragments that don't become pixels, and that's called depth complexity. We're really looking to minimize the depth complexity because fragments that are behind pixels that don't become pixels, they're wasted work. Okay, we're completely off topic. But anyway, so if I say pixel and fragment, you guys should know what they mean. So this is written in HLSL and GLSL, these are high-level shading languages, and they'll get compiled down into some assembly language, like we see here on the right-hand side. And these are actually, this assembly is relatively high level, I would say, compared to what we've seen on the CPU, in that it will have like square roots as one, as one function. It will have multiply adds, fuse multiply adds, so it can do, it can multiply two values and add them all in the same instruction, and that's actually good for precision as well. So an unshaded fragment comes in, we run from processing on it, and we wind up shading the fragment. Okay, so in the simplest manner here, we look at what we need to execute the shader, and we need fetch and decode logic to get an instruction from the instruction cache and figure out what it's supposed to do. Then we need code to actually execute it, which is the ALU, arithmetic logic unit, like we see in the CPUs. And then we have what I'm going to call the execution context, which is, we'll say, the registers and maybe the instruction pointer, or also called the program counter. That's kind of the local data that is relative to shading that pixel. So really, just if you just think registers, that's good enough for now. And everyone remembers what a register is from last week. Good. So we walk down here and we shade this pixel. Here we go. We're doing one instruction at a time. That's okay, I guess. Now, if this were a CPU, look what else we would have on this chip. A really big data cache, right, to kind of hide going out to main memory. We'd have out-of-order control logic, right? So this way we can kind of take a single instruction stream and try to exploit the parallelism as best as we can, including register renaming. We're going to try to do branch prediction so that this way we don't have to stall the pipeline if we don't know where a branch is going to go. And we're certainly going to prefetch things from memory. And this is a whole lot of transistors, right? You guys remember Varun showed that slide on where the transistors are spent on a modern CPU. What if we just got rid of all of that? Okay, we're getting rid of anything that we didn't need. All those things to make a single instruction stream run really fast, let's not have them. And this way we can take the same transistor budget that's used on a CPU and do something different with it. What do you guys think we're going to do?
Add more cores.
That is half this course. Why not make it two cores, right? So now we can shade two fragments in parallel. Why not add four cores? Now we can give four fragments in parallel. More realistically, why not 16 cores? We can do this with our transistor budget if we don't have these big caches and big control logic. So here we have our GPU right now has 16 cores. It can do 16 simultaneous instruction streams. And see, since we have different control logic here, which is in orange, it can do 16 different instruction stream. So it could actually run 16 different shaders. So not only if we had the globe, but if we had other models or something like that, they may be ran with a different shader. But remember I showed you many of these pixels, they're actually running the same shader. Like that big globe, that was all one shader, right? So why not even save more transistors by sharing the control logic? So why not fetch and decode one instruction and then execute it across multiple data paths or multiple sets of data? So why not take one instruction, execute it for 8 fragments all at the same time? Okay, so now we're kind of sharing this fetch and decode logic across, for in this example, 8 fragments. So now we need 8 ALUs, and then that context, now we're going to need to break that up to have, so we have 8 different sets of registers. Good so far? So one way to do this is with SIMD instructions, right, which is kind of explicit instructions to get this parallelism. And we see that in CPUs with SSE2, which is what Varun talked about. Now, the GPU, we're not necessarily going to do explicit parallelism here, or explicit SIMD. But what we see here is 8 fragments coming in, 8 colored fragments coming out. Now, what do? We take our 16 cores, and we let each core be able to shade 8 fragments at the same time, right? So now we can do 128 fragments in parallel, so that's 16 times 8, right? So you have 16 simultaneous instruction streams, 16 different shaders, 16 different programs, if you will, each of which can do 8 fragments at the same time. Right, you guys see how we're fitting this on the same chip now, because we took the control logic and really simplified it so we can run the same instruction on multiple pieces of data. And again, right now in this talk, we're really talking about fragments, you know, shading individual pixels. But like I said earlier, it could be vertices and graphics or even full primitives. And then some of you, I'm sure, are very interested in doing general workloads, you know, whatever your area of interest is. But you can imagine if we're doing matrix multiply, which we'll talk a lot about in this class, for every element in the output matrix, that could be one workload. Okay, so now branches, they're a huge deal in the GPU. They're a big deal in the CPU, but branch prediction is pretty good. But I said we got rid of our branch predictor, right? Because we want to use those transistors for all those extra cores. So now, say if we have the shader on the right-hand side, where we have a branch, where there's if statement. And now we have one instruction that's running on 8 different fragments, right? So what happens if those fragments that are supposed to be running the same instruction, if since they have different data, they can take different parts of this branch, right? So we have to figure out how to deal with that. So here, from left to right, we're showing 8 different fragments that we're shading. Some of them went true, some of them went false on this branch. What would you guys do if you're designing this GPU? Go to your boss and ask them, what should we do? What kind of options do we have? Not let the branches diverge? This is called a divergent branch, by the way, if the branch takes both sides. So some go one way and some go the other. We basically execute both sides of the branch, and we mask out the branch to the side that we shouldn't have taken. So divergent branches, where multiple fragments that are being ran in the same processor with the same instruction, you wind up divergent branches. You wind up hurting performance because you don't get the maximum amount of parallelism, right? So if they all went true, there's no need to execute the false side. Or if they all went false, there's no reason to execute the true side. But now we're doing both sides because we have a divergent branch in this particular processor. And we're going to talk about strategies for minimizing divergent branches. The way that we divide up our work, we can kind of minimize these, and then we'll wind up with more parallelism to get closer to the peak performance. Okay, so one thing about SIMD here is we showed earlier SIMD, which was explicit vector instructions, right? So in the GPU, we're actually not going to use explicit vector instructions. And instead, the hardware is going to determine this. It's going to kind of do this implicitly for us. And the hardware does a lot of the scheduling overhead for us. Like, we're not going to schedule individual processors or anything like that. We're going to give it a group of threads, basically. And the hardware is going to determine what processors run what threads. And this group of threads, or this group of fragments, in NVIDIA is called a warp. And we're going to use that term a lot this semester, a warp. And what we're saying here, you know, we were showing eight instructions running all in the same data. You really will see it up to 64 sharing the same stream. And in the architecture, we're going to be looking at the NVIDIA G80. You're really going to see a warp size of 32. So 32 fragments or 32 threads all sharing the same instruction stream. Okay, so memory access is a big problem. So we have all this compute, but if this compute needs to go out to slow memory, we're going to eventually stall. We're not going to be able to do any more compute because we don't have any data to access. And we got in a CPU, what do? We have a cache hierarchy. We go L1, L2, L3, and now we kind of try to minimize the amount of times that we have to go out to main memory, right? Because we have everything in a cache. But we said we don't want to spend transistors on a cache, so we have to come up with some other way in order to keep performance high, right? And still have all of our cores. So the thing here is we have lots of independent workloads, right? I showed you that globe and we were shading all those different fragments, right? We have thousands of them, tens of thousands of them. So if we're executing, well, let's just jump to the next slide. Here we go, we're doing eight fragments. We're running on one processor here and they have to go to main memory. Okay, so now we can stall and we can wait, you know, a couple hundred cycles or a thousand cycles. Or, since we have so many different fragments that all need to be shaded, why not start shading another fragment? So we just very quickly in hardware, you know, like zero time or one cycle, let's flip in a new set of eight fragments or a new warp, a new set of eight threads. Oh, that one stalls. That's fine. Let's flip in another one. That one stalls. Fine. Switch in another one. And we have so many fragments. We have such massive parallelism that when something stalls, we can swap in another warp or another group of fragments that can do actual work. Okay? And then eventually, the first one who stalled will get switched back in. At that point, the data will come back from memory. All right, this is very, very important. Yes?
Does it safe to assume that the amount of transistors that we spend in building the control logic for stall detection and lining up new sets of fragments, but or is it safe to assume that the transistor budget for that is sufficiently low that we don't, is it better?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So the trade-offs here, we care about things with massive parallelism. So when we're designing this GPU, we have such parallelism that, yeah, the branch predictors are not that important to us. But as we're going to see as this course, as the GPU has evolved, the GPU starts becoming looking more like a CPU, and we'll look at systems on a chip towards the end of the semester. We'll look at a CPU and GPU on the same silicon. So now some of the GPUs are actually starting to get a little bit of cache and things like that. But you should assume that for massively parallel workloads like the GPU, we're really just looking for as much compute power as possible. Other questions? Okay, so the other thing that I just want to emphasize here is the throughput versus bandwidth, right? So throughput versus latency. So the latency to run any given warp or any given group of fragments is now increased because they're going to get swapped out and they're going to wait a while before they come back into main memory. But the overall throughput is now awesome, is now very good because we have so many cores that we can just really bang these things out. And in graphics, we care a lot more about throughput than we do latency. And in fact, when you're doing graphics, you know your code is executing, rendering a frame, where the GPU is one or two frames potentially behind you. But at 60 frames a second, it usually does not matter. Okay, so I want to talk more about the context here, where I said, hey, we have a bunch of registers, we have a bunch of program counters. So we have this fast memory, it's on a chip. We can divide this memory up in all sorts of different ways. One is we can have maybe, say, 18 small contexts here. So now we can say that we can host up to 18 warps Okay, is everyone comfortable if I start using that term warp? Think of group of fragments or group of threads. So say I can host up to 18 warps here. So this particular chip can run, can have 18 warps on it such that if one stalls, we'll swap in another warp. Okay, so we can kind of try to hide memory latency. But I could also divide it up into, say, 12 contexts. So now we only have 12 warps to play with if we need to swap in something on a memory stall. The thing is, each context here is bigger, meaning that each shader or each individual thread has more registers to work with, so it can do more work potentially. Or here is four very complicated. This can only host up to four warps, where each individual thread is probably doing quite a bit of work or has quite a bit of local memory. Okay, let me see. Okay, let's stay on this for a second. So this is very important here when we look at small contexts to hide a lot of memory latency, or big contexts because the individual threads are going to do a lot of work. What this is going to wind up meaning is when you write your kernels or you write your shaders that run on the GPU, if you start using a lot of registers, you're going to wind up needing bigger contexts, which means you're going to have less ability to hide memory latency. And sometimes you're going to hit a wall. Like suddenly you're going to add like one line of code and your performance is going to drop 50%. And you're going to come to me and go, why did my performance drop 50%? And this is going to be the reason. And this is one reason why GPU programming is harder than writing a regular CPU program right now. It's because you really have to be aware of maybe, you know, how many registers can you use and what's going to happen if you start using more of them. And I'm not, it sounds maybe like I'm always advocating writing really small kernels like this so you can have maximum memory hiding. And that's not always the case either. It's a very, you know, this is not a cut and dry trade-off here. But this that I'm showing you here, also 18, 12, 4, this is not like burned into silicon. This will change based on the needs of the shaders. So, and we're going to talk more about this throughout the semester. In fact, everything that we talk about today, this is like a million-mile bird's-eye view. We come back over everything today, the branch divergence, the idea of running warps, the idea of hiding memory latency through swapping in different warps. We come back to all of this over the entire semester as we look at actually programming this thing. So don't, you know, feel, I just want you guys to get kind of a feel for everything today, and then we just start going deeper and deeper as we start to program it. Okay, so as I said before, the hardware here is going to schedule all these warps for us. It's going to pick individual processors to put them on, and when things stall, it will swap in everything for us. Okay, so now let's look at this chip. We have 16 cores here. Each one has 8 ALUs, and since we have 16 cores, we can do 16 simultaneous instruction streams, potentially different instruction streams. And here we can have 16 concurrent instruction streams, but not all running at the same time, because we have 4 contexts in each of the 16 chips. So only one is going to be active, where the other three will be waiting to be swapped in. So here you're looking at a total of 512 concurrent fragments. Right, so if you clock it at a gigahertz, we'll call it 256 gigaflops. Now, if you're making a GPU, you might just up the number of cores, up the number of ALUs per core, and now it's a teraflop. Now you go market it and say it's a teraflop. It's a big deal, as long as you got enough transistors. What questions do you guys have about this picture? It is going to be quite big. I don't have the numbers for you here, and I'm pretty sure this is a realistic chip. But it's pretty similar. Yeah, in fact, we'll look at the 480 here. At the end of the semester, or even like 2 weeks from now, you guys will be able to draw this like from memory, and you'll be very comfortable with it. Okay, so let's just look at some of these main ideas. Right, we took a beefy CPU core, and we pulled out of the caches and branch predictors, etc. So we slimmed it down, right? So now we have a bunch of cores, and we put a bunch of ALUs in there, right? So that now we can we can take one instruction and run it across multiple pieces of data. And then when we look at memory access, we're going to try to avoid the stalls by swapping in different warps or different groups of threads. Those are the big things I really want you to think about. Okay, so now we'll take a brief look at recent NVIDIA and AMD cards. And today, like, this is not on your homework, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but this is kind of going to foreshadow some stuff that Varun will talk about. Because we're really going to focus on this class and, like, the first pure GPU, which will be the NVIDIA G80 or the NVIDIA GeForce 8800, which came out in late 2006. And if you have a good grasp on that, it becomes much easier to look at these more recent GPUs. But with that said, let's take a look. Oh, yeah, and here's a disclaimer. You should see when Kayvon gives his talk at SIGGRAPH, he's always like, I'm not actually talking about performance for NVIDIA and ATI. I'm not in marketing. I don't want anyone to come talk to me saying, you know, this is the actual reality. But these are pretty reasonable ways to think about these chips. Okay, so NVIDIA will say that they have 480 stream processors, 480 cores. Right, so in our terminology, we're really looking at that's really actually only 15 cores, each of which has two sets of 16 LUs or 16 SIMD units. In fact, so that's why when you see this term core, watch out, because we say a CPU has four cores, right, or maybe eight cores. And then you see a GPU that's hundreds of cores, where these cores are actually much closer to ALUs than they are full-blown cores. Okay, so here what they're showing is execution context in blue here. And then there's also this thing called shared memory, right? And we're each chip has a little bit of shared memory. And a really big topic in this class is how do you bring things into shared memory so that this way you don't have to go all the way out to global memory, which we're going to see is really expensive. And that is not done automatically for us. That is not like an L1 cache or something like that. That is something that that is a piece of memory that we explicitly manage ourselves. And we're going to look at how do we take threads, as a group of threads, and how do we make them coordinate with each other such that they all help each other bring stuff into shared memory so that they can execute really efficiently. So the most interesting thing to look at on this chip is that it actually has two fetch and decode units. So this individual chip at the same time can execute instructions from two different instruction streams. And you also see this, the warp size here, the number of fragments that it does in parallel from one instruction stream is actually 32, which means that it needs two cycles to dispatch each one. But we'll get to that stuff. So they slap 15 of these things on a core, and then they say 23,000 fragments that you'll need to saturate this. And we're always going to be looking for huge workloads, right? So graphics naturally has huge workloads because look at the number of pixels on the screen. But when we start looking at other problem domains that we want to use the GPU for, we also need to have really big workloads. Okay, so the Radeon here, they say 1,600 stream senior processors, right? That's a lot. So really, when we look at this, we think that it's 20 cores, each of which has 16 ALUs or 16 SIMD units. But the difference here is that they're really using VLIW, very large instruction world, to try to get more parallelism out of each individual instruction stream. Now, we'll see. I saved most of this for Varun's talk, but in their latest architecture, they've actually moved away from this, and it starts looking a lot more like the GTX 480 that we've just looked at previously. So let's jump over this. Okay, so well, we're doing pretty good on time, which is great. Usually, I'm afraid that I'm gonna be short, and I'm always almost over. So we're doing good on time. So let's talk more about moving data around, because this is really important, and sometimes we're going to see that, well, not sometimes, pretty much, if you take something on the CPU and it's embarrassing in parallel, you put it on the GPU, you might get like a 10x performance gain if you just like naively do it, and then you're going to be bandwidth limited, right? And you're going to be running like at the speed of the memory for the GPU. And then you're going to spend a lot of time to try to get rid of that or kind of minimize our bottleneck on the memory bandwidth. And then you might get to like 100x. Like, it's not uncommon when you look at GPU researchers that they'll be getting 100x performance gain doing things on the GPU. Okay, so we said this data cache, right? We got rid of it. But in a CPU, we have the L1, the L2, the L3. Everyone's comfortable, right, with these things. The closer to the processor you are, the smaller they are, but the faster they are. Now here on the GPU, we wind up with main memory. The throughput is pretty good. It's 150 gigabytes per second, at least on like on the G80 type architectures, which is a lot faster than the CPU. I want to say they say it's like 6 times faster than system memory. But we have so much compute going on that is not enough bandwidth to really keep our processors busy. In fact, let's look at this example, which I kind of already alluded to earlier. So this is basically Saxby, right, where we have three different arrays. We read from each array, that's 3 memory accesses, and then we multiply 2 of those elements and then add the 3rd element. So this is, you guys have heard of Saxby before, single precision AX, AX plus B, right? Well, except this is ABC. And then we store the result into a new array, right? So we got 3 memory accesses, and then we got 2 computations, or yeah, probably 2 computations plus a final memory access. So if we were to work out the math here, we're going to say this thing is incredibly memory bound, memory bound. And in fact, it has less than 1% efficiency on the GPU, where the cores just can't be busy because we have so much memory access that we don't have enough actual compute to do to keep it busy. So, you know, we can't hide this. Because, like I said, we just can't hide this with swapping in various warps. So we really need to look for ways to overcome this, right? And one is find better problems to run on the GPU. But we'll also look at techniques for what I'm saying, using shared memory such that we're not actually going out to global memory, but we're bringing that into a shared memory that's close to the chip and very fast. And like I said, we'll look at doing that manually ourselves because we have to, and we'll look at some of the coordination there. And I think that's a really cool topic. And we're also going to see that when we start doing CUDA first, right, which is the general purpose computations, we're going to have control over all these things. And then we're going to start doing GLSL, right, to do graphics. And we're going to see that it's a lot more limited, actually. And like I say, the parallelism is all implicit. And this is going to be an interesting, I don't want to say experiment, but in the past, we taught this course the opposite way, where we really started with graphics and built up the GPU through the graphics pipeline, and then did the general computations. So I'm pretty excited to see how this works, where we're actually looking, just fundamentally, we're looking at the GPU as a general, massively parallel processor. And then we're going to look at the graphics as kind of a specialized case. You guys will have to give me feedback on how that works for you, both those of you that have strong graphics backgrounds and those of you that that potentially don't have strong graphics backgrounds or are more interested in the compute side. Definitely let me know how this works for you, because based on your feedback, we'll either keep the course this way in future semesters or we'll change it back. You know, I haven't completely lied to you guys, but I've sort of lied saying that there's no caches on the GPU. So there are some caches on the GPU, but we dedicate much, much less transistors to them than you would in a CPU. And in particular, these textures or these 2D images that we're using for shading, like in the globe example, there's quite a bit of coherence where when you're shading fragments next to each other in the screen, they're probably reading from very similar very similar locations and textures, so that spatial and temporal coherence there is really good. So we do have small texture caches that are used for graphics that are read-only memory that are quite fast. And then you'll also see some custom silicon for doing things like texture filtering, where you might have to take multiple pixels or texels from that texture and shade one pixel with them. So we'll do things like linear or bilinear filtering. And you can actually get, by the way, the texture memory from the general general computations with CUDA. And in fact, one thing that we'll look at that's really cool is you can combine both like OpenGL and CUDA in the same application, so that OpenGL is doing graphics and maybe it's outputting textures, and then you can share that resource and then run your general CUDA kernel on it. It's very cool. Okay, so now, not necessarily in the G80 that we're going to look at for most of this course, but in more recent architectures like that GTX 480 or the or just what's generally called the NVIDIA Fermi architecture, there are some small caches now that we're seeing on chip and on the GPU. And really, because what they're trying to do here is they want the GPU to become easier to program. And it's really starting to look more like a CPU. And in some ways, a CPU is starting to look more like a GPU, and then they keep adding more and more cores. And eventually, there's a separate multi-core programming course. Has anyone ever taken that course here, multi-core? It's a 500-level course that Milo teaches. I mean, eventually, we feel that these architectures are going to merge, and then this course will actually merge. Okay, so my actual prediction there is that these courses merge, and then a separate real-time rendering course comes out to the side of this to handle the graphics part of this course, which I think is very important. Okay, so, you know, long story short, right, the GPU is a massively multi-core processor, and it's really optimized for throughput. We're trying to do a lot of fragments per second. We don't really care about seconds per fragment. Okay, that is the end of his talk. Well, thank Kayvon. I'll definitely credit Kayvon for this talk. So tell me, what questions do you guys have about the GPU architecture here, the major things that we talked about? All right, let's jump way back and just go ahead.
Yeah, question. Can you go over, during what scenario does a core stall again?
When does a core stall? Yeah, so we try not to stall at all. But if you have, so say, look at this chip here, where we have four warps that can be scheduled. If all four of those warps on that particular chip, if all four of these are stalled on memory access, then this chip can't run anything. And at least that's true on the G80. I'm not sure if something crazy happens on the more modern architectures where they might try to swap in completely different warps. I'm not quite sure. I don't think that's the case, though.
Is that related to the bandwidth being limited? Because later on, we're talking about that, and you're saying you can't hide that by stalling.
Right. So the main memory. So these are chips, and then there's also main memory that can main video card memory. And you might see a video card might have like 4 gigs or 6 gigs of memory. It's incredible. That, you know, is like 150 gigabytes per second, but each of these will also have shared memory, which is much faster, which is like, it might be as fast as accessing a register.
So the stalls that you're talking about are going to share memory?
No, stalls? Well, actually, you can have banking conflicts, which are outside of the scope of today's discussion, but the stalls that I'm really talking about are going to main memory, main GPU memory.
Yeah. I'm just curious because later on you said that going to the main memory, the bandwidth is limited, but and there you can't hide by stalling. It's just a little no fun.
Yeah, so main memory, right, is 150 gigabytes per second, and yeah, you hide it by swapping in different warps, by swapping in other pieces of work that can actually do computation. You don't hide it by stalling. I mean, that doesn't hide it, right? Because stalling just waits. Just see if you have more questions, just see me after class about it and try to clear it up. What other questions do you guys have? Yep.
So what about interconnection between the cores?
The interconnection between the cores.
Yes.
Because you guys, when you guys were doing your sorting example, you guys were all communicating with each other. That's how you're asking. Warps that are within a processor cannot talk to warps on another processor, with the exception of going to global memory and locking global memory. Okay, and that will hurt parallelism. In fact. we don't want to do it. We want to do it as least as possible. And we want to hold the lock for the shortest amount of time. Now, threads within a warp, they can work in shared memory here, where they can coordinate using shared memory, but you still got to be careful that you still got to be careful that you use it appropriately. And we'll have like at least an entire lecture on that. Yep.
Is it possible to get each core to sort of write to one specific subsegment of, for example, like texture memory, and then get around it that way? Because like, instead of having to write all the way back, go all the way back to global memory, you can just write it.
Yeah, so the texture memory is actually read-only, and it's because from the graphics point of view, you never actually write to it, so it's only read-only. Now, individual threads, they can write to shared memory located in that processor that then other threads can read from, right? Other threads on that processor can read from.
So that still doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, so there could be some crazy techniques that I'm unaware of, but... The de facto standard is to go to global memory if they need to coordinate. And much of this course is avoiding going to global memory. What other questions do you guys have? Yep.
How do you determine what exactly constitutes a fragment since it's not exactly
pixel? Yeah, so let me talk a little bit. This is more of a graphics issue than it is like a general GPU issue, but let me just make sure it's really clear. Let's say I'm going to draw a 3D scene, and I'm going to draw it. Here's my viewer, and I'm looking this way. And I like to do really sophisticated graphics, okay? So I'm going to draw 10 spheres, or I'm only going to draw 5, because I don't want to draw all 10. And they're the exact same size, and they're all right behind each other, okay? And I'm looking straight down this. At the end of the day, when you're looking at this screen, that's generated from that scene and this point of view, what do we see? We see the front side of one sphere, right? And it looks maybe like a circle. Everyone's comfortable with that? And let's ignore something called backface calling for the moment, or we'll probably ignore it today completely. But when I sent these spheres to the video card, there's 10 fragments here. Each of these is called a fragment, but only this guy actually becomes a pixel, because these other fragments here all behind this guy. And if you were to assign depth values to these, you would see that this one has the smallest depth value, you know, say just pick some number 0 to 1, such that ones that are closer have smaller values. And we'll talk about this in more detail. But those of you that took 460/560, this is very, you guys are very comfortable with this idea, right? Someone shake their hand for me. Good. Okay. So is this clear? Okay. So I just use the term fragment. Because it's usually more precise, because we wind up shading fragments that don't become pixels. Although there is, you know, a ton of work into how do we minimize the number of fragments, that don't become pixels. There's a million techniques on doing that. And a lot of it is, some techniques are built into the hardware, but then we have to change our software to take advantage of those. Okay, and then so what fragment is also, you think of, and at this point in the class, think of any of this. Think of fragment, think of thread, or even kernel, and we'll see the term CUDA kernel being used a lot. And then when you group a bunch of these together, and in screen space, these fragments are probably like right next to each other. And we call that a warp, or that group of fragments. What other questions do you guys have? So every detail doesn't need to be clear, but I just want these big idea pictures to be in your head, so that when we start looking at CUDA, which we will on Wednesday, that we can really start flushing out these individual ideas and really learn how to program against these. Because I really care about you guys being able to write code on the GPU that uses the GPU efficiently. That is my motivation for if you're successful in this class, that you're able to do that. Yep.
Shared memory is on the individual core.
Each individual core has a little bit of shared memory.
So the context, the blue squares, are first accessing the shared memory, or they are directly calling the GPU memory?
No, these blue squares, this is all memory that's local to the processor.
So they're not shared memory.
In this diagram here, I would say that this is down here is shared memory, and then these are individual contexts, or those are individual sets of registers. Yep.
On the CPU, how does one process determine the shared key? If one wants to communicate via shared memory, then how do we set the shared key of
the CPU? On a CPU?
Yeah.
It's kind of outside the scope of this class, but most of the CPU stuff memory is memory, and you can lock around it, and as long as you're not accessing the same variable at the same time, you're usually good with race conditions.
When we write two programs, do you write the same shared key in both of them? Is it something
operating
system decides something on
it? I'm not sure what you're talking about. Does anyone know on CPU threading shared key? Has anyone heard that before? Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that is. Other questions? Okay. All right, so the roadmap from here is we're going to look on Wednesday, we'll start looking at CUDA, and this will become more concrete too. So for those of you, I know those of you that have strong computer architecture backgrounds, probably look at this and you're like, man, this is very, very fluffy, very high level, very, very easy. But for those of you that don't, you might be like, wow, there's a whole lot of computer architecture. I didn't know I signed up for this. But we're really going to get concrete with programming this. So I think that's great on both sides. But we're going to intro CUDA for a couple lectures. And then we're going to look at some of the parallel algorithms, like building blocks. And then we're going to look at a lot of the performance, because this class is all about performance, right? Then that'll almost bring us to spring break at that point. So what I want to do now is talk a little bit about the first homework. I sent out emails to the Google Groups last night with some instructions on how to get that and how to submit it. If you're not on the Google Groups, you need to get on it right now. And if you don't have a GitHub account, you should also make that as soon as possible, because that's how you get the homework. So I actually want to briefly introduce source control so you guys know why we're doing this, why we're trying out the homework assignments this way this semester. And again, this is something that we haven't done in the past, but we're trying this semester. And I'm all about, to me, this is a bleeding edge course. So this course has to change and it has to evolve, every semester or every year. So I'm always willing to try new things, and so far we've been very successful with everything that we've tried. But your homework is just one text file. It's got 10 or 11 questions, really based on Varun's lecture and today's lecture. But I want you to access it through source control, modify it, then submit it back to source control. And I'll explain a little bit about exactly how to do that and the general idea of source control right now. So before we start, remind me again, how many people have used some type of source control, whether that's Git or SVN? Just about everyone. Good, but not quite everyone. Okay. So hopefully my motivation here is pretty simple then. All right, say we have two people working on the same piece of code or the same source file, right? How do we have people collaborate? I mean, we could email it back and forth. I don't know if anyone's ever tried that. It's a nightmare. We could try Dropbox and just try to be very, very careful with Dropbox. Right, but what do we do with 200 people collaborating on the same code base? And 200 is not out of the question. I mean, you guys will go out in the industry or work on maybe some big research projects, and you're going to have a ton of people working on the same code base. I mean, how many people work on Windows at Microsoft? I'm probably not allowed to know that. Matt, you were about to raise your hand. Yeah. Oh, you know? Okay. Is that publicly available data?
Yeah.
Okay, don't tell us. But you know, at my work, our flagship application, we have maybe 60 people working on it, and it's like 5 million lines of code. So you can imagine that we need nice ways to coordinate that work. You know, and also backup. Has anyone lost a lot of work because they didn't back up their code? Matt? Okay, a few people had, right? So we're definitely interested in really having our code backed up, right? And what about a history of changes? You know, what? Maybe I need to revert back to an older change. I'm trying some risky change. What do? Do I copy and paste that, put that in a separate folder, and then make my change, you know, for the best, you know? Or maybe I want to look through the history of a file or a set of files because maybe I'm reviewing some code. Or maybe let me ask you this: What if we did a startup right here? This is the 565 startup, right? And we made a product and we're going to release it, but now we got to do some risky changes. You know, maybe we're going to optimize for the latest GPU architecture. How do we do that without affecting the stable branch, right? Or how do we work on multiple versions of the same product? Say I ship, you know, okay, so we're 565 and we make, you know, WizBan application. We ship 1.0, and now we're working on version 2.0. But now we need to fix bugs in version 1.0. You know, we got to be able to coordinate all these different versions nicely, right? So the answer to this is we use source control, which is also called version control or revision control. I don't know. It's got so many different names now. I don't know which one is the most popular to use. And you've probably heard of some of these tools. Perhaps Subversion or SVN is pretty popular in the open source world. That was written to replace something called CVS. Perforce, we use Perforce at my work. And I think Google uses it to some extent. And then probably the most popular nowadays, at least in the open source world, or in the world that I'm playing in, is Git. And the most popular hosting for that is GitHub. And these are tools that allow us to really control, track our source code over time and collaborate on source code. So I think it's very important that everyone here have experience with this, because when you go into industry or you go into serious software projects, you're going to be using this all the time. And for you just to get in a good habit using it now, I think it's very much to your benefit. We're going to use Git because Git is... I want to say it's up and coming, but like it's already here. Like it's dramatically popular. So I want to make sure that you guys know how to use it. And actually, this is somewhat of an experiment for me because I'm a long-time Perforce user, and Git is very new to me as well. So we got a lot of learning to do. But I want to tell you a little bit about the differences, the two main classes of source control. This idea of centralized source control, this is what SVN and Perforce does. Where we have one server, right, and that's where our code resides. That's our repository. That's our source control. That's our source code and all the history of that source code. It's a centralized server, right? And then each client or each machine can connect to the server and get a copy of that code, just a snapshot of that code in time. It might be the most recent code or it might be slightly out of date. And everything goes to the centralized server. So maybe I have some code. And for now, you know, if you really want to be think simplified about it, that's one text file, right? One computer has one text file. And it creates a new branch on the server and submits some code to it, right? Just think of that like almost like FTP upload. And now the server has that code. And now these other clients, they can get the latest revision of that code. And the terminology I'm using here is mostly Perforce terminology. And now you have three clients, and they all have the same version of the code. Someone can modify the code. They can add new files, remove old files. And then, I keep going the wrong way. They can submit that to the server, and then the other users can, again, get latest revision. So the idea here is that we're submitting files to the server, and we're getting files from the server. So everything's centralized in the server here. And we can do, it will coordinate things for us. Like if I work on some code and you work on some code and it's the same file, and one of us submits, then when another person goes to submit, it will help us resolve those changes. And it's actually really good at automatically resolving, unless you do something crazy. Like, you know, say you have a function and you each add a separate argument to the function, you'll have to merge that by hand. But the benefit here, right, is the server, so we're automatically backed up on the server, and the server may be replicated. The server has a history of the files. You have multiple people working on it. Now, the other way to do this is a distributed or decentralized version control. And this is what we're going to be using, and we're going to be doing this with Git. Where now, instead of each machine having just a single copy of, one copy of a snapshot of the repository, you actually have the entire repository, the entire history of all your code changes on each client. And then clients, or we'll just call them nodes, I guess, they can clone other repositories from other clients, and then they can push changes to other clients or pull them from other clients. So it's just kind of like free-for-all, or think of it. Now, even though this is decentralized, you typically have a computer where that is kind of like the master copy. And in our case, GitHub, this opens this website that hosts our Git repository, that's kind of like our master repository. Right, so someone can locally create, when I say repo, that's short for repository, someone can locally create a repository and add files to it and locally make those changes. And here's some of the Git. I'm going to show you guys, by the way, how to use the command line. And then it's up to you if you want to keep using the command line or if you want to use a GUI. So someone in one machine, they can, they make the repository, they add some files. And then other machines can clone that repository. In fact, this is exactly what you're going to do. I made a repository for each of you that had a GitHub account. And if you don't, you should make one. You should email me and I'll do it for you tonight. I made repositories for each of you. And then you guys are going to clone those so that you have your copy of it. And then you guys are going to modify your local copy. And then you can commit changes as often as you want locally. And eventually you'll push it back up to the GitHub repo. And this won't happen, though, which is why here you can imagine another student pulling your change. Because everyone's repository, if I did this correctly, is private. So only you can see it, and Varun and I can see it, which was nice of GitHub because they usually charge for those. But for our academic use, they gave us free private repositories. So for all your homework, you'll have that private repository. Now, when you go to do your projects, I'm definitely going to encourage you guys to use a public repository to do your projects that's open source. I definitely encourage that unless you're leveraging some of like your homework answers or something like that. Then we can talk about it. So really, long story short, we're using Git for our homework this semester, and I'm going to show you guys a concrete example in a second here. And I want you to think about using source control all the time, for all your projects, all your classes, and not just for code either. I mean, you can put, like, our website for this course is in source control. Put your resume in source control. In fact, employers will probably like that, if you bring that up in conversation, they'll be like, oh, wow. So definitely use it, and just, it's a little bit of a learning curve, but you get through it now, and it's just going to pay dividends for the rest of your career. Okay, so when you log in to GitHub, and I made a user, CIS565 test. I needed to make sure that this actually worked before I went to tell you guys, right? When you log in to GitHub, you'll get a page like this. And you should see an organization here that's CIS 565 Spring 2012. And this is our class organization. And when you click on it, like I said, I made repositories for each of you. So you should see your username and then homework, capital homework, capital H, all one word. That's your repository. Whoops. That's your repository for doing your homework. And if you click there, you'll see it's got one folder right now, homework 1. And you can imagine there'll be homework 2, 3, 4, 5. And it's just got one text file, homework 1.txt. Right, so you could just click on this, and here it is. We have it on the web page, just the homework. Look, it's so easy. You guys will be done in an hour or a half hour. And if we were old school, you could copy and paste this into like Notepad or something. You could do your homework and then email it to me. But what I want you guys to do is take this repository that's now on the GitHub server, and I want you to clone it locally. Okay, and I sent out the instructions on how to do that, but I'm going to do it again here in front of you to see if it works with everyone watching. So after you install GitHub, after you install Git, and there's instructions for doing that that we sent out. Git bash, right, is a command line for using Git. Right, I sent some instructions. The very first thing was a git clone instruction. And this clone instruction, and you'll replace the CIS565 test username with your username. When we do this clone, we're saying, hey, I want to make a local repository based on this remote repository. Now, for me, it's going to ask me for a passphrase. When I made my RSA thing here, for some reason, I put in a password, and now it's like the worst thing ever, because I'm typing my password all the time, and I don't recommend doing it. Although, I don't know the security implications of not doing that. Matt, do you have something to add about that?
Yeah, you can use Pagent.
Pagent?
Yeah, Putty's. There's Putty's utilities. Pagent will store your passwords.
Okay. We should probably talk about that at some point. So now that's it. Assuming that you set up Git correctly, you now have your local repository. So you should have a folder called homework1 and a text file called homework1.txt. So let's go into that directory. Okay, so I got one text file, right? Now we can come in here and we can do the homework. Okay, why are gigaflops an imperfect performance measure? Don't tell me, but here's my answer. So I don't know, nor do I know how to spell. So I can save this. Okay, now maybe I'm in a mad rush and, you know, it's 5 minutes before the deadline. So I can commit it, and I'll give it a message, you know. Now, this commit here did not put it back in GitHub. This is a local commit to your local repository. So then you say git push, and now you're pushing your repository up into the GitHub repository. And look, it asked me for my password again. Now, because we're paranoid, we're going to go into GitHub and make sure that it actually got this change, right? So here we are back in GitHub. And now look, homework one, age, just now, message, best I could do. So it sees that I just pushed this. And now let's look at homework one. So it's got my answer, right? Now when you do your homework, you're welcome to commit locally as much as you want. You're welcome to push remotely as much as you want. And, you know, you can submit it 100 times, especially when you're doing your code. I assume that you'll want to do that a lot. And as long as you, we're just going to look at your final push before midnight of the due date. So for homework one, that's due a week from today, right? So as long as you get it in there by midnight, then you don't have to email us. You don't have to do anything like that. Just submit it, and we'll come look through your history, and I think this is going to work out really well for us once we get over getting everyone set up with Git. Now, let's say, I don't know, there's some worst case scenario and, you know, you're like me and you're on your work computer and you can't get to Git from your work computer because of some security implications you don't understand. You know, and you wait till the night before and things are just messy. If you have to, for this assignment, you can download the text file from the website, and you can email it to us before the due date for this assignment, right? Because I understand this is new. This is a pilot program. If we have bumps in the road, you guys aren't responsible for those bumps. You know what I mean? This is something new that we're trying. So if you have to, we can submit this kind of a more traditional, older route. But I have high expectations for using Git, and I hope that at the end of the semester, you guys will tell me that you think it was worth doing. Okay, so tell me, what questions do you guys have about the homework in terms of the logistics for getting the homework, doing it, and submitting it? Has anyone cloned the repo yet? Some people have done it, and it worked okay for you guys? Great. Okay, well, then you guys are out a few minutes early. Have a good day.